I'm also excited to announce our newest sponsor, Tegas. Tegas has the world's largest collection of instantly available interviews on all the public and private companies you care about. All you have to do is log in and type in a stock ticker or a keyword. For example, if you're interested in gaming stocks, you can type in RBLX for Roblox. Or type in the keyword metaverse and instantly read hundreds of calls on the company and industry. Tegas actually makes primary research fun and effortless too. Instead of weeks and months, you can learn a new industry or company in hours, and all from those that know it best. Now, I only sponsor products that I use every day, and Tegas is no exception. Since joining, I spend nearly all my time reading Tegas calls on existing companies and new ideas into my portfolio, and I know you will too. So if you're interested, head on over to tegas.co/valuehive for a free trial to see for yourself. Again, that's tegas.co/valuehive. This episode is brought to you by Quarter. Quarter is the new way of doing company research. Quarter's first mission is to enable access to conference calls, investor presentations, transcripts, and earnings reports as frictionless as possible, straight to your pocket. I started using Quarter and I've never looked back. You can think of Quarter as the Spotify for all investor conference calls that you can think of. You can type in the ticker of whatever company you want, say it's Etsy, and you can get a list of all of their recent earnings calls. And inside the earnings calls, you can listen and click the PDF and it'll show you investor presentations or prepared remarks that you can read alongside listening. The best part is you can choose the speeds. You can have 1x, 1.2, 1.5, which is my favorite, and you can star companies, make them your favorites, and you'll get notifications for new conference calls and they'll be right at the top of your app. So there's five key points to remember about Quarter. First, it's 100% free. They include companies from 12 markets and plan to add more over the coming year. They prioritize requested companies, which you can do in the app, and they have a lot more in store. So check them out on wherever app store you have. It's Quartr. That's Quartr. This episode, we're going to go into the physiology, biology, and neurological side of investing and just general performance with Louisa Nicola, founder of NeuroAthletics. Louisa, I met her doing, I think it was the Peloton Twitter spaces where we actually first interacted, but I think you dropped in on a couple others and you provided excellent feedback on Peloton. Really, you were like the only female providing feedback on the product, which, you know, we need to get more females talking about Peloton. And luckily we were able to connect and then do a Twitter bull versus bear debate that you were a part of. But this podcast, we're going to talk all about your passion in neuro performance and kind of what you do at NeuroAthletics. So to start, who are you and how did you end up founding this company, NeuroAthletics?
So first of all, I'm very excited to be chatting with you. It seems to be a regular occurrence with you and I. Once a week, we're doing these chats. So I love it. So Louisa Nicola, I was born and raised in Australia. Now, the way I got into neuroscience and neurology is I started off as an athlete. So I was an elite triathlete. I raced for Australia. I ended up qualifying for Beijing and then again for Auckland towards championship series. So that was around the time that in my early 20s, when I was completing my first undergraduate degree, I'd been training for like 6 years, learned the ropes, what it takes to be an elite athlete, training 5 hours a day, fell in love with it, but there was something missing. And it was this aspect of when I was about to go to the World Championship Series, I realized that the only thing that's going to make me faster, you know, like you probably know this, when you're an athlete, there's two things. There's an expiry date, but there's also this cap. And the cap is there's going to reach a cap where you just can't get any better physiologically. You know, you can maybe get an inch faster, but it takes a lot of time once you're at your peak. So I thought, what's the, how am I ever going to get faster? And it was all because of neurology. I found out that you can record electrical signals in your brain. This was back in 2012 or 2010, I believe. You can record these signals in your brain and they mimic game day races. And I thought that was so incredible. And that's where I really became introduced to the brain. And I decided to dedicate my entire life to it.
So when you say record these neurological simulations in your brain, like what does that mean? Yeah.
So I had an accident. I was hit by a car when I was traveling on my bike. And they say that you're not a professional cyclist until you get hit by a car. So I got hit by a car. Thankfully, I made it out alive, but I got out with a lot of broken bones and, you know, I was out. I couldn't walk for around 20 weeks. And wow. At that time we had a very special guest flying from Colorado because I was obviously in Sydney at the time. And it was Usain Bolt's running coach. And he was coming to do a running lesson with all of the elite triathletes as we prepare for world champs. And I remember he said, Louisa, the only thing that's going to get you back up on the bike is if we put these things on your head, these electrodes, and we measure your brain waves and we find out where the fear is in your brain and what's really stopping you from getting back on the bike. I said, what is this thing that you're talking about? And he said, it's called an EEG. So he put this cap on my brain. And back then, you know, we only knew an EEG to scan the brain for epilepsy, which is what it's primarily used for, okay, in the area of seizures and epilepsy and other different neurological diseases. So when he put that on my brain, he figured out the areas of the brain that were most responsible for fear. And he kind of took me through a triathlon in my brain, you know, kind of visualized it. And I thought it was incredible. It's the first time I'd ever seen my brain waves on an actual EEG. I saw waveforms and I asked the neurologist, I said, what is this? And he told me. And so I ended up going back to school. I studied medicine, I studied science, and I had a very, very deep interest for neurophysiology.
How hard was it for you, even though you saw these brain waves, you got to train your brain to redo, basically run through another triathlon, but how hard was it to go from mentally doing that to then physically putting yourself back on the bike after an accident like that?
You know, it was twofold. It was very scary because you have this initial thought that, oh my God, I'm going to get smacked by a car again. I kept hearing the noise of the car hitting me. But then there was this other sense that I was fearless in terms of, well, I've already been hit by a car. So if it happens again, I know what it's going to feel like. So it was pretty crazy. However, I never recovered fully. I was always, you know, it took me like 10 times more work to produce the same results. So I never got back to my original position.
And working 10 times as hard, was that 10 times as hard physically, or was it just mentally your brain was just maybe basically lowering its cap on what your brain thought your body could do, if that makes sense?
Both, because you have this, you know, with athletes, it was very emotional because I was at the top of my field. I was at the, you know, I was a podium finisher, you know, I got top three places on all my races. I then qualified for Beijing and it happened, I think 2 or 3 weeks before I had to fly out. So I actually, I had to forfeit my position. So that was very emotional. So just the entire process, I was set back. So then when I'd go for a race again the following year, I'd have people passing me that I used to pass. And it was emotional. It was hard physically. My knee never recovered. It was a mess.
Yeah. Well, it's funny how you mentioned when you go through those dark days, there's that fear of trying to get back into it. And then there's also that fearlessness. And I think that plays well with investing and what a lot of portfolio managers or individual stock pickers experience with drawdowns. So when you have that big, let's say 50% drawdown in a position or in the portfolio, there's that fear like, oh my gosh, like kind of like, I mean, it's not physically the same, but maybe mentally it is the same as getting hit by a car. And then there's that fear of, do I buy that next company? Like, do I make the next position? Do I sell? Have you experienced any of that when talking to portfolio managers where it almost feels like they've been hit by a car?
Oh, so many. And, you know, it's interesting. I put out an email newsletter today and it was all based around three of the biggest challenges I find across the board when it comes to my investors. And it is fear, greed, and uncertainty. So these three things, especially as it ties into the brain, which I'm sure we'll get into later on. But when it comes to making a decision based on past experiences, I find that part is skewed for the investor. You know, they're scared. They're like, you know what? I don't know if I should make the same trade. I was, you know, I lost or got hit by a car, but I lost 10 mil, 20 mil, even 100 grand. I'm scared to do it again. I'm scared for my investors. So many different things goes on in their brain, which is why I correlate the performance of an athlete to the performance of a portfolio manager.
And then what is that recovery like for the portfolio manager? I guess we'll call it a therapy where Usain Bolt's coach would strap on the EEG to you and have you run through a simulated triathlon. What is the corollary between what you do for portfolio managers or investors?
Well, the good thing is I actually, at NeuroAthletics, that's what we do. So when we take a cohort, if you say, when we take a bunch of investors, let's just say a company has hired me, which is, you know, what we do now. And they say, well, Louisa, we've got 25 investors that we need you to work with. I see it as I have 25 brains because that's what, you know, I learned and that's what I know. And I have my own EEG machine. It's a hospital grade EEG that we have at the company. And so we go in and we actually scan the brains of all of our portfolio managers. And the beautiful thing about this is, and I never go into the psychology realm. I believe you have to stick to your lane. My lane is neurology. That's what I know. That's what I've studied and that's what I've learned. So that's what I've based the company around. And I look at the brain, the hardware, what's happening from a chemical level. You know, that what is happening in the brain. The only way to really know that is if we get imaging. So when we go in, we scan the brains of these portfolio managers. It spits out a report, a 32-page report, and it's quite fascinating. I can pick up on information processing speed. This is how fast is their brain neurologically able to process information, calibrate it in the brain, and then make a decision, an intelligent decision. We pick up on visual acuity, just the same as, you know, an athlete, like an NFL athlete who thinks they've got that 2020 or 2010 vision, we may be able to say, actually, your visual acuity, according to a brain scan, shows that you're only operating at like 80%. So we come up with all these different things that can actually show the portfolio manager, hey, you're actually not performing at your peak. Even if they say, oh, I made $2 million with this trade, or I made XYZ. It's like, but you could probably be making more and living a better life if we just optimize these three areas.
Wow. And that's something we're going to get into a little bit later, but there's two questions I want to ask before we dive in. And that's about when you first started studying neuroscience and neurology and how it kind of relates to brain and performance and athletics. Were there any assumptions that you had about the brain or about performance, whether it was your own assumptions based on your training or your friends, that when you started studying, you realized were completely false? And then what were those specifically?
I wouldn't say false. First and foremost, there's a lot of myths around neurology. This whole, you only use 10% of the brain. You know, the truth is we use 100% of the brain 100% of the time. If we didn't, we'd probably be in a coma. So I had this notion of, in order to perform better, it comes down to these psychological tactics, meaning what am I thinking? How can I turn around my thinking? And that was interesting, the psychology. But when I really understood the brain, and you look at the ventricular system, you look at how the brain is formed from, you know, prenatal to 25 years old, when you understand the vasculature of the brain, you realize, my thinking can change if I change the hardware, meaning I learned about sleep physiology, the importance of sleep. That's something that before I started studying, we never took sleep into consideration as athletes. We were taught sleep less so you can train more. I learned what overtraining does. I learned what glucose does. I learned what mitochondria is and how that affects the brain. And then I learned different things such as cold immersion versus sauna sessions, how this changes. I learned about genes, like what, you know, most of us, our biology really dictates our performance. We've got over 20,000 genes in the human genome and everyone's different. So your genes, the way that you've made up is a completely different genetic makeup to me, which then determines a lot of the things that we think and do and the way we act. So it wasn't so much, you know, this thesis of that theory was wrong. It was more so developing an understanding of medicine and the brain, which then in turn helped me with my thesis now.
Got it. one
if
of those
makes sense.
Yeah, it does. One of those theses, and again, a lot of the research that I did for this podcast was just scanning through your Substack posts, which are great, by the way. And one of them that I came upon was Andy Murray and Warren Buffett, and then the reward prediction error.
Oh, yeah.
And it was kind of all those three. And I'm a big tennis fan, so anytime I see anything tennis related, lights pop up in my brain. You mentioned this one denominator that doesn't, basically you said, you know, there's not much of a difference between someone like Warren Buffett and someone like Andy Murray from a performance decision-making ability standpoint. And you argued that that one common denominator is the ability to make sharp decisions. And so let's, if you can, I want to unpack that neurologically and physiologically. What makes a decision a sharp decision versus, again, like a dull or a non-optimal decision?
You know, it all comes down to, first of all, we have to understand how our brain makes decisions. And we've got different structures in the brain. Okay, we've got four lobes, and all, you know, within the lobes, we've got over 80 billion different neurons, and they all act to produce different things, okay? Seeing, hearing, language processing. And there's different parts of the brain that's involved in thinking and decision-making. We've got the prefrontal cortex, which sits at the front of the brain. We know that we call this the executive functioning of the brain, but there's different regions within the prefrontal cortex that's involved in actual decision-making. We've got the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. We've got the posterior cingulate cortex. Then we've got these other deep structures within our brain called the caudate nucleus, the ventral striatum, and the putamen that are really involved in this circuitry. So when I say the differences, I mean that we have an individual performing at their peak in one sector, and that's finance. Then we have another individual performing at their peak in another sector, okay, and that's tennis or athleticism. Now, the similarities are they both have a brain, and the way that they process information is the same. However, how well they process that, how fast they process that, is really determined by what they're doing on a day-to-day basis, how well they're sleeping, what are they ingesting, you know, nutritionally, what are their biomarkers in terms of like, what does their blood work say? And so we can get all these different measurements. And it's not that, you know, people say to me all the time, Brandon, Louisa, can I hire you to do this? Is, you know, do your services match me? And I'm like, well, if you have a brain, then yes. So that means that any really individual can come to neuroathletics. So it doesn't lie, you know, getting to that peak performance doesn't lie within the realms of, well, am I in the right sector? It's let's just scan the brain. Let's do all the measurements that we can, and let's use the protocols to optimize those certain areas. The reason why I believe that decision-making and making sharp decisions, you know, is the ultimate successful formula for a portfolio manager is because so many things lie in their day-to-day of making decisions, right? You can only imagine, how many decisions do you think you make on a daily basis yourself?
I mean, I feel like there's tons that I'm just not even thinking of. And I don't like, I mean, and this is stripping out, like I wear the same thing every day. Like I've, my fiance jokes with me, but I've got six shirts I think I wear every, I mean, it's like the same six shirts and I wear the same like outfit. So I strip out that and I pretty much eat the same thing. But still, I feel like and then you go into like what companies to read, what investment decks to read, what stuff to respond to. I mean, it's probably hundreds or maybe thousands.
Exactly. And let's imagine that all of those decisions come down to a glass of water. Every time you make a decision, you've taken a sip of water. Okay. So there's just one glass. Even the decision to go to the bathroom, to reply to a text message. These are all decisions. And dependent on how full that glass is, will be dependent on how many decisions you can make. And as you get lower and lower and you've got like a few mils left, that's when you're like about to, you know, you're drained of your energy and you think, oh my God, if I'm going to make this decision, it might not be good because I've only got like a mil or two. That's exactly what I believe is, you know, what we believe as scientists is brain endurance. It's like, how far can your brain go in making good, intelligent decisions? Just like you train your body, It's like you train your muscles for endurance. It's the same thing with your brain. You have to feed it well. You have to hydrate it well. You have to treat it well to build up the endurance, to be able to make better decisions for a longer period of time.
Which I guess is one of the reasons why Buffett always says he likes to keep his schedule wide open. Cause you know, you talked about like what you ingest and what you sleep. Like I would love to get Buffett's blood markers, because I feel like he's got a terrible diet, but he probably sleeps well and he probably has his schedule set so he doesn't have to make any, like, I mean, any decisions, obviously in quotations, but he gets to decide what decisions he makes, and that helps a lot.
Oh yeah. And this is why I, you know, I got out of the clinic system where, you know, you're taught to go in without sunlight, you go in, you work 12 hours a day, you come home and you're just mentally drained. You know, I'd rather work hardcore like Buffett. He says he only needs to make, what is it, five decisions or three decisions a year for his financial.
A couple good ideas a year.
Yeah, exactly. And that is, I really truly believe that, not just because he is where he's at. Yes, you have to get to that position to be able to do that. But if you can work 3 hours a day, really hardcore, and just be able to just leave it there and just meditate for the rest of the day or get out in nature, I think you'd be much more productive than if you were working 50% of the effort, 8 hours a day.
Yeah. I mean, that's something I struggle with too, because there's these two camps, and we'll get to this when we talk about sleep, but personally, there's two camps that I fall into where it's like, if you're not working, someone else is beating you. And then the other camp is you need to not work because you'll burn yourself out. And, you know, when you were running triathlons and competing at the highest level, I'm sure you battled those two camps as well. What would you say to people, especially in knowledge-based, you know, environments and work, where really, for me, there's no separation between work and pleasure. So everything I do can relate back to what I do for work. And so it's hard to kind of detach and really take time off. Mm. What do you say to those that struggle with stuff like that?
I think that, you know, I think you have to get yourself to a position where you can't just, you know, someone fresh out of college with no network and no, you know, who hasn't put in the work, can't just go and make, you know, a few good decisions a year. You have to get yourself to a position where you know, you can do that. So for me, for example, in my 20s, I spent 5 hours a day, 7 days a week training. I was also going to school. Okay. Mm-hmm. Not high school, but I was also going to postgraduate university, college, you call it in America. So I wasn't getting home, and I was trying to have a social life. I didn't really have that much of a social life, trying to fit in family. So I was really burning the candle at both ends. I was going to bed late. I was young. Okay. In my early 20s, for some reason, I just don't recover the same now, but I did put in the work. I did put in that work to be able to now go out and consult for companies, because I've done, you know, the 15 years of work.
Yeah.
So right now I've accepted that there are more important things to me now, you know, health. I'm much bigger on my sleep and prioritizing sunlight, getting out in nature. Whereas when you're in your early 20s, it's like, I don't care. I'll stay up all night and I'll go out and have a drink with my girlfriends. And yeah, it's a much different life now. So I think you have to choose what's important to you.
So in a way, and correct me if I'm wrong, in a way, is it almost the fact that you have to earn the right to take your foot off the gas pedal? For instance, where like you have to do enough work at the beginning to earn the right to then say, all right, I'm going to slowly, you know, reduce what's on my plate. And really having that freedom to make less decisions is a privilege based on all the hard work you did up front. Is that kind of the way you're thinking about it?
That's a very good analogy. And that's exactly what I was trying to say. Yes.
Got it. All right, cool. So let's go into the second part of that Substack essay, which is, I'm a fan of Andrew Huberman, which is the tweet that kind of led this whole discussion, but he tweeted about reward prediction error. And so I think this plays perfectly into what we struggle with as investors. How do you define reward prediction error? And then how is it detrimental to making optimal decisions?
Yeah, I love this, because I read a book around 2 years ago and I interviewed the author. And it was, the book was The Molecule of More, and it was all based around dopamine. And I'm sure you've heard of dopamine. I'm actually going to pull up the Substack as you're talking about it, because I love that you keep referring to it. But dopamine is this molecule that is, we get mixed up with, you know, when it comes to neurotransmitters and which are, you know, chemicals released from one area to the brain in response to an action or thought. Okay. So we get these release of neurotransmitters, and this one, dopamine, is really, really interesting. And this book changed my entire life, as it, you know, it showed me what dopamine as a molecule actually is. And it's heavily reliant on pleasure and rewards. Meaning, I describe it as this motivation molecule, meaning that we need dopamine to keep pushing us forward. Okay. So, but in order to keep pushing us forward, we need to actually create it. And the way it's created is in this, you know, in this reward prediction era, meaning that if I go out and I complete a task, let's just say, Brandon, that I want to do a 5-kilometer race. That is my ultimate goal. In order to keep telling my brain that you're going to achieve it and keep pushing myself to get there, I have to achieve little milestones. So let's just say I say to myself, well, in 10 weeks, I want to run 5 kilometers. So each week I break it up and I say, each week I'm going to run 1 kilometer at this pace. If I keep breaking it up and I achieve little results on the way, I'm going to get this huge rush of dopamine saying to me, Louisa, you've done such a good job. You've achieved that 1 kilometer. That's all you had to achieve. That's mm-hmm. so great. Now next week you can keep achieving it. So you keep going, you keep getting towards this big goal. So that's this reward process. It's this reward that we feel when we win a game, we complete a big deal, and that's the thing that keeps pushing us forward. So it's this reward system that keeps happening in our brain. But what happens is, in elite athleticism or even in everyday life, we see the big goal, the 5-kilometer race, and we don't know how to reverse engineer it. So we see it, we try and achieve it. Okay, it's 10 weeks away. I try and achieve it by week 3, and I've told myself, you failed, you're a loser, you're not going to get it done. And we put a halt on that release of dopamine. So it stops us immediately from trying to go further and achieve that goal.
So how do you then, I mean, this is going to be a loaded question, like, how do you fix that then? And the only reason I ask that is because in investing, and depending on the type of game you're playing, obviously you can be a shorter term trader, but let's say you're a longer term investor and you're making decisions today where you're only going to be, you will only know if you're right or wrong in, say, 5 or 7 years, which is a huge delayed effect for the dopamine hit. And so how do you then compare and contrast, or how do you game plan for making decisions today and then setting those markers so that a decision that's only going to pay off potentially in 5 years, you can still track and you can still make sure that that dopamine is there for you to keep going?
Well, see, that's the underlying effect, right? They call this the Bill Clinton effect. When he achieved presidency, he got to this point where afterwards he felt like he was falling down a hill. Okay, he went into depression. He spoke out about this. That's because his last and final goal in the world was presidency. And once he achieved it, he didn't know what he was going to do afterwards. This happens with athletes. Yep. They get to the NBA. That's all they wanted. Then afterwards, how many times do we hear that ex NFL player has gone and killed his doctor, or ex NBA player is now addicted to drugs? It's because they reach this goal and they don't know what to do afterwards. So in order to really fix this, the way that I've come up with that with a lot of my clients is, you have to understand, first of all, you know what your year goal is. You reverse engineer it. You have your monthly goals. And then it's about really accepting on a day-to-day basis what things are. And that's such a hard thing for even me to describe. Okay. It's really because every day, especially with Twitter and social media, you're always trying to compete. You're always trying to compete with someone you think you're on a good roll, you see something and you're like, oh, maybe my goals aren't big enough. So it's really just, it's owning what you are It's owning who you are and just keep rewarding yourself with dopamine. Because once you do that, once you do your daily tasks, you'll be able to accept that. But one rule of thumb that I have for everybody, and I do this with all my clients, is they have five things, okay? Five musts on a daily basis. If they, and I make them do this every single day, you have to write down your five things that you need to achieve. It's your hit list. I don't care if you get it done in 15 minutes or if it takes you all day. That's your five things. Everything else outside of that can come as a treat. If you get those five things done, you can either go to rest, you can go and do something throughout your day, but you have to have those five things done. And it sounds so simple, but it's like a power list. And I use it, and it's very rewarding because you're like, huh, I've done my five things. I can rest or I can do more work. It's fun. It gamifies the system.
Yeah. And it also plays into this, at least it plays into this idea of if you don't do it, there's almost like a sense of guilt throughout the day. If you know you have to get something done, or if you know that there's things you have to get done and you don't do them, there's this sense of like, oh my gosh, like there's this weight of, I still have to get this done. I've got these things. But I guess that's the power of the checklist, is you're like, look, you bang these out as you go through it. And then let's say you get all five done and you're halfway through your day, then you can open it up to, you know, the creative side of things, where you just let ideas come at you serendipitously.
And also just remember that your brain likes consistency, just like it likes to sleep at the same time every night and wake up at the same time every day. If you can train your brain to just do these five things, you already have programmed in your brain at the start of the day, okay, I already know what I've got to get done, so I'm going to get those done. And then it really is great. I do it all the time. Sometimes though, I may put 10 things on my checklist, which doesn't work, but yeah.
So is five like the sweet spot number, where it's like, it's not too few. Yep. It gives you the whole day to do them, but then anything after that, you're starting to overload yourself.
Yeah. And get this, a lot of my portfolio managers, I have to say this, about 99% of my clients are men. So now they're finding, you know, I'm getting messages, I'm getting emails saying, oh my God, so happy. I ticked off my five things before 12 and now I'm going out with the wife and kids. We're going out on the boat. And I'm like, oh, this is amazing. Whereas before, they would not have anything in their head. They would not have this power list. They wouldn't know how to structure their day. They'd be doing things. Maybe they'd take the dog for a walk, hang out with the wife and kids, try and do something at like 2 p.m. and it would just be all over the place. So now they've got this. Sometimes people just need somebody to tell them what to do, but now they've got this list and they're achieving things and they're seeing better results in their work and in their family life.
And that's interesting, because a lot of jobs have switched to work from home, and a lot of people that listen to the show are one man investment shops. And so, you know, they just kind of whatever they do during the day is whatever they do. There's no one kind of watching over them. You can get into a habit of spreading out all of your work throughout the entire, let's say, 12-hour waking window, when you really could do all of that, like you said, in kind of this 3 to 4 power hour session. And it's just fascinating, because I've experienced that in my own life, where if I set some stuff to do, like, all right, I'm going to read this investor presentation, then I'm going to write 500 words, then I'm going to send these emails, then I'm going to write this podcast outline. If I do all of those things, I can tend to do those by, you know, let's say like 12 o'clock or 2 o'clock. And then I have that whole time just to like read a book that I've been wanting to read for weeks. That's just been sitting on the shelf because I haven't had time.
Yeah, absolutely. I see that all the time. And I think the biggest marker of being able to focus during a time like this is, for me, it's now that I'm home and I'm doing most of my work at home, I'm like, okay, I don't really need to clean, you know, do the laundry right now. Like I have a laundry in my apartment. So I'm like, okay, maybe I'll clean the bathroom. And it's just like, you've got to find what your focus is and what your distractions are. It might be the television.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to circle back to the sharp decisions topic. And when you put on the EEG with the portfolio managers, and you can see their visual acuity, how fast they process information. When you said, you know, there's some that are really good and there's some that are really bad, what are the actual, we'll call it, you know, therapies or modalities that you will put on the underperformers. So, you know, I'm not asking for the secret sauce, but what are some tricks and tips and some tactics that you use to take those underperformers and bring them to where everybody else is or where, you know, the peak performers are?
Well, why don't we start with the one thing that I can say is a one size fits all. Everybody needs different protocols because everybody has a different way of functioning in terms of right. their brain. So I struggled for many years to find something that doesn't outperform sleep. Everywhere in the literature starts with sleep. You can't get this done unless you've got sleep down pat. You can't fix this unless sleep is there. So I think that the sleep is the one size fits all. So why don't we focus on that thing? And as a specific protocol, what we would do is we'd first do a sleep analysis and we'd figure out with our portfolio managers, hey, how well are you sleeping? What's happening in your sleep? Do you sleep well? We do things like we've partnered with companies where we put wearables on them, trackers, so I can actually track their sleep and say, don't lie to me. You actually only slept 3 hours last night. You know, because a lot of them used to lie to me. So we're able to see that and think, huh, okay, John, today you woke up. How did you feel? Louisa, I felt irritable. I felt clouded, like my head was all foggy in the mornings, and then in the morning and then around 1 p.m. it kind of cleared up, but I'd already done all my work by then. My emotional regulation wasn't at its peak, and I go, huh, let's look at your sleep scores. Oh, John, you slept for a total of 6 hours, okay, which is terrible, by the way. And in terms of percentage, your the time that you spent in REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, was 8% of your total sleep time. This is why you're feeling all these things, okay?
Right.
So, you know, so REM sleep, okay, it's one of the phases we have in sleep. We have non-rapid eye movement and we have REM, rapid eye movement. And the reason why they're called rapid eye movement is because when we seep into this position, our eyes make these like horizontal shifts really rapidly. Yeah. That's what we see on an EEG. And so when we go into REM sleep, we should be aiming for our total sleep time to be made up of 20% of REM. During REM sleep, which happens later on as you fall into sleep, later on in the later stages of sleep, we have memory consolidation. We have this other great thing where our glymphatic system kicks in, which is basically the clearage of all of these toxins in our brain so we can wake up feeling fresh. If we haven't gotten adequate REM sleep, we're going to wake up with all of the things I just discussed: cloudy judgment, inability to make good decisions and sound decisions. Information processing speed is going to be delayed. We're going to have decreased visual acuity. So many things are affected. So this is where the sleep analysis and protocol comes in. So John, the reason why you're not achieving all of these things is because you had a terrible sleep. You had a terrible sleep because you only had 8% of REM. You only had 8% of REM because tell me what you did the following day. Oh, I went to sleep at 1 a.m. I had a few beers with the fellas after work. I ate fried food. And when I got home, I got home at midnight and I decided to binge on some TV. So I got bright light and then I kind of just drifted off on the couch. So these are all of these things are going to equal a terrible night's sleep. So Brandon, do you see this process that goes around like this? Yeah. And the reason why people don't take it seriously is because they think one night of bad sleep isn't going to affect me. Well, it is if you're trading. You know, I've got some PMs who are like trading like a lot, like the investors that they're taking care of is they've got a lot of money. So if they make one bad decision on that day that they lost sleep, then that's a very terrible thing.
Yeah. I mean, you could be sacrificing hundreds of millions of dollars by sacrificing that hour of sleep. And that's actually the cool thing about the Whoop strap that I got last month is it shows like my sleep debt. And I think I average like a half hour of sleep debt every day. But it is.
It comes up with a debt. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I mean, I think so. Let me, if I'm looking at my app and I go to sleep, I think it does have sleep. Yeah. So like hours versus, so it's like hours you got versus hours you need. So
okay. Yep.
I'm averaging, I guess like 7.8 1 hours of sleep a night, which again, probably not great. Probably need to be between 8 or 9. But keeping on this topic of sleep and then work and then this whole mindset of, you know, grinding all day, how do you kind of destroy the myth then that, you know, of this grind culture where like it's go to bed late, wake up early, work, go to bed late, wake up early again, because investment and, you know, the game of investing is very cutthroat. And there's so many smart people that a lot of us, myself included, feel this urge. Again, like I said earlier, like if I'm not working, somebody else is, and then they're getting smarter while I'm not. So how do you go about kind of dispelling this myth with your clients or even with yourself in your own life about like, no, rest is important. And maybe it's okay if I don't work 16 to 18, you know, 12 to 14 hours a day. Like maybe I sleep more. And then over time you see those benefits.
This is so interesting. And this is why I formed NeuroAthletics based on science, because there's one thing that doesn't lie. And that is, I always say that is the medicine. So when it was, you know, 10 years ago, when it was all about psychology, a PM could lie to you and say, no, I'm good. I'm, you know, I can get by with no rest. I'm feeling good and I've got no problems and I'm making good trains. I'm making good money. It's like, okay, let me check your cortisol. Let me check your hormones. Let me check your blood work. Oh, these things don't lie. So you may be making a lot of money. You may be feeling okay due to adrenaline. How are your relationships at home? How do you actually feel? What is your weight like? What's your lipids? You know, I get a lot of men saying, but I feel good. And then I get their lipid profile and it's like, okay, your cholesterol is, you know, if you don't stop this, you may have a heart attack in the next 5-6 years. So It's all really dependent on this thing of health span and lifespan. How long do you want to live and how well do you want to live throughout that? We can all go through now on little sleep. Okay. It's going to be detrimental over the long run, but we can do it and we can survive. Okay. Maybe for a week we can make really good decisions and then spend a week not making that many good decisions and just get by. But it's dependent on that whole notion of, is money the end game for you, or do you want money to have a good life? So this is where you've really got to pick apart who you are, what you want. You know, if somebody said to me, Louisa, I don't care if I die in like a year. Don't worry about my blood biomarkers. Don't worry about how long I'm going to live. I don't care if I'm going to have a heart attack. What do I just need to do to get money? That's a completely different story, right?
Right.
So if you're, you know, just like you said, you're always, other people are working harder than me. Well, you don't know that for sure. And that all just comes down to what is it that you're trying to achieve and being okay with that. Because I believe, especially in, I live in New York City and with the internet, your life can change in an instant.
Yeah.
For example, not that I know if this is going to change my life, but let me just give you a quick example. I have to fly out this weekend. I'm going to the Money Show in Vegas. I got an opportunity to present for that day. I wasn't trying for that. I didn't go, and that was my end goal. Things just come to you as you move along. And I think that's the thing with entrepreneurship that you have to accept, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I think this problem is exacerbated because of Twitter and really the power of social media, where anybody, you can see anybody working at any point in time when you're not. So if I'm in bed, let's say, and it's, you know, 6:30 in the morning, or let's say it's 10:30 at night, I'm in bed scrolling through Twitter or something, and I see somebody like, hey, I just released this deep dive on this company that I just did, or hey, you know, I just wrote 5,000 words, or hey, like I just put together this whole thread. Like there's this part of you that's like, gosh, like I will never be able to keep up with the pace of everybody else. And it's, I mean, obviously it's destructive, because that's not the point.
Yeah.
But there is, I guess what I'm trying to say is that there is that pull that I experience, and I know that others do.
I can't say that I haven't experienced that, because I do. You look at other people's life and you think, and I was atrocious at doing this, actually. Look at somebody's life on Instagram, for example, which is just a highlight reel, and so is Twitter.
Yep.
And you make this, it's like fear, okay? Fear is just these unwanted negative thoughts based around a theory that might happen in the future. Okay. And you fixate on that. And they say that if you don't get it out, your fears, or if you don't get out what's bothering you, it gets bigger and bigger and you start to believe these manifestations. And that's why we have these anxiety attacks. But you look at these, you look at somebody and you make this prediction on that photo. And it's funny because I used to think that. And then when I'd really get to know this person, I think, oh, that was just a fake, you know, that was just a fake photo pretending to be happy and masking what they're really feeling. But then it's like, okay, you go to Twitter where you don't see photos and you just see what people are doing. Like they're, yeah. Hey, I just released this report, like you said, or I just did this. It's figuring out why does that, it's like triggering. It's like, why does that get to you? What is it that they are doing? Are you their direct competition? Do you know what they're bringing in? What's their annual revenue that they're bringing in? Is that what you want? And it's never about the other person. It's always about you. So that's why I think that there's great businesses out there, great business models with great founders that completely jeopardize the progression of their business because they want too much too soon. They're not patient and they go out and they do what you said. They see something else. They get distracted. They see that they're doing this. So they stop their goals. They stop their movement and they're like, oh, I've got to go and put this report out because they just did that. And it completely just interferes with what's going on in their tunnel. So there's this analogy I use with a lot of my athletes, and it is, I want them to be able to become, I hate this word, but unbreakable. Okay. Have this unbreakable brain and mindset, meaning that I want them to envision themselves, and you can do this. Imagine you're in this tunnel. Okay. And this tunnel is spherical. It's made out of steel. Okay. And you're walking through this tunnel. At the end of the tunnel is your goal. Between the tunnel and back here where you are right now, people are throwing things. Okay. And that's the negative thoughts that's their photos of them doing really good things. That's this, they're throwing it. And when you're in this thick tunnel, okay, and they're throwing something, what's going to happen? That's going to rebound back off and you're not going to feel it. You're not going to hear it because you're in this steel tunnel. Yeah. That steel tunnel is your brain and how well it's functioning. So if you've had a terrible sleep, that tunnel, the outside of it is a bit thinner. Okay. So when somebody throws something, it's going to affect you. It's going to nudge you a little bit. Okay. Cause you're going to be affected by it.
Yeah.
Sleep is emotional first aid. What about something else where we're just sticking to our tasks? We're not looking at social media. That's going to create a bigger and thicker tunnels. Okay. Made out of steel. And I always say, is your tunnel made out of steel or is it made out of paper where people can break through it? And it's a really good analogy that I use. And for some reason it just sticks. And that's how you have to think about it. There's always going to be distractions. There's always going to be somebody doing something better than you. So
I love that, actually, that visualization of the tunnel. I think, I mean, if anybody's going to listen to this podcast and get anything from, you know, all the knowledge that you've dropped, that tunnel visualization is tremendous. Cause I think it just bodes so well, cause you've got the tunnel vision, which then hyper focuses you on your long-term goals, and everything else is just a distraction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
I don't know if you want to say this, but I was just going to ask you, some of your goals? Give me one goal, for example.
Man, one goal here. Well, so my goal is to run a successful investment partnership. You know, that's one of my goals. That might be too broad, right? Because then it's like, how do you define success? Well, you know, for me, it would be 25 to 30% IRRs over the course of the partnership. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, so that's per, you know, professionally, and then, you know, growing the macro ops business that we have, our premium service, you know, growing that to a nice sustainable level. And then personally, I'm getting married in 7 months. So it would be,
congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. It'd be amazing to just have, like a foundation set for our future family, to have like, you know, guiding principles and rules and just, you know, kind of a family ethos that I've set before we, you know, ever bring children into the world, and, you know, just to be a good brother, be a good son and friend. And, you know, so it's like all those distractions, fit in, but it's really like the professional ones that I think I struggle with the most. Because
just stick to the professional ones.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the professional stuff, it's like, that's where the competition is. Like, I don't feel like I'm competing in like my personal life. It's just professionally. So, you know, and then I think what happens is I associate how much content I produce with how effective I am or how valuable I am. So like if I'm not releasing new content every week or releasing new things, doing Twitter spaces, doing deep dives or everything, then I feel like I'm not meeting those goals. And I think that's where that sticking point is.
Well, then what I would say to you is, for one thing, your brain is like a server mechanism. Let's just say your brain has this, you have to be able to put your goals on the head of a pin, I say to my athletes. And by the way, when I say athletes, I call my portfolio managers athletes. That's the ethos of neuroathletics, having an athletic brain. That's where it came from when we formed the company in 2015. So when I say to my athletes, you need to be able to put it on the head of a pin, and they say, why? I say, because your brain can't go out and scan a million different things in this big wide system and go and get it. It's not how it works. The way it works is if you can pinpoint it can go zoom, and everything else becomes obsolete. That's how you get into the tunnel. People say, I've got tunnel vision. But what is your tunnel? Is the end of the vision outside of the tunnel? Is it just too broad? Because then that tunnel is going to keep going.
Yeah.
You need to be able to, this is what I say, how can we mitigate risk if we haven't really understood a risk analysis? To have that risk analysis, you need to understand, well, what exactly are my marks? Like, what am I aiming for? Let's do something really, really easy to help with this. So I started my Substack, and I started this because I wanted to get my name out there to the broader community and be able to show what I do with my NBA athletes. I want everybody to have access to that, okay, yeah, on a scalable version. I had a goal. Instead of just starting the Substack and saying, we're just going to go for it and just see how we go, I had a goal, very easy for me to achieve. I had a goal of getting 20 signups a week, free, okay? If I didn't do this by midnight on Sunday, I would start going around my building and ask, like, because for me, the only thing my brain knows is 20 emails, whether they're made up emails or whether I get them from, it doesn't matter. That's what my goal was. That was easy for me to achieve, but see how it was clear and concise, like 20 email signups a week. Mm-hmm. That's how, and so how do we mitigate risk from that? Well, we have to make sure that we're, you know, getting, you know, 10, you know, in the first 2 days, or we have to really, that's how your brain works. Instead of saying, I just want it to grow.
Yeah.
I just want my email to grow.
Yeah.
It's your brain works better if it's got this single point. And so the reason why I asked you, like, what's your goal? And you said, I really want a successful company. For your brain, okay, the more that you see, the bigger that it tells your brain that success is, but you haven't put the guidelines in to get yourself there. So that's why I always say, like, I think social media should come with an emotional license. Are you emotionally fit enough to take on Instagram? Do you get affected by what you see? Does it get in the way of what you're doing?
Yep.
And yeah.
I mean, it's funny. You see that in Twitter too, like emotionally, where people will post things or they'll say something, and then they'll get like in these vicious fights, and then they'll block a bunch of people that don't agree with them. And emotionally, it's super hostile, but from the outside looking in, like, I mean, I've been blocked by a handful of, you know, pretty well-known people. And I just find it hilarious that people like,
really?
That, yeah. I mean, the emotions rise so high for things that don't matter. It just, I don't know. It just makes me laugh.
Yeah. And it's interesting that people really do take this, this thing, this is their entire world. It's like, you're behind a screen. Let's sit in person and let's have a talk about it. They won't do that. So like I said, you've got to just choose what you want, figure out what's important to you and just go for it. As long as you're not making anything illegal, and as long as you're not hurting anybody or harming yourself, then you should just go for it.
Let's say I am a terrible sleeper. I sleep like crap. I get 6 hours of poor quality sleep. What are some, again, some tools and tricks that you use? Yeah, I meant you mentioned light exposure. Again, I'm not, you know, everybody's sleep is different, right? So one person may only need 7 hours. One person may need 9 or 10. What are some one size fits all, broadly based things that investors can do to optimize their sleep and get a better night's rest?
Okay, rule of thumb. 2 hours of sleep before midnight is worth four hours of sleep after midnight. So you want to be aiming to be asleep by 10 p.m. It's hard to do. What does that mean? If you want to be asleep by 10 p.m., 10:30 maximum, you want to start priming your brain to be getting into sleep at around 9:30. Dimming the lights, not doing any emailing or heavy activity. You know, putting maybe some blue light blocking glasses on, not that they're going to have that much effect. Really not eating, just trying to calm yourself down. So then you're warming up for sleep. That's number one. Second thing is caffeine plays a very big role in determining when we start to get sleepy. I always say don't have caffeine after midday. Okay, that's the second rule. Third one is the way that we fall asleep and start to secrete our sleepiness hormone, which is called melatonin. It's released in response to darkness from the pineal gland. This is released based on what we call our circadian rhythm, which is this internal clock. And that's predicted by this 24-hour cycle. So to sum that up, when you first wake up in the morning, the first thing you want to do is get some daylight. Okay, it wakes up the circadian rhythm. Okay, and it's predicted that 12 hours after you wake your circadian rhythm, that's when the hormone is going to start to kick in. So if you get out and wake up and get sunlight at like 7 a.m., you know, at around 7 p.m., 7:30, you're going to start to wind down and feel a bit sleepy. So these are the things that are really only going to work if you really want it to. It is science, unfortunately. I don't believe in this notion of let's just see how we go. There are a number of different things that can affect you from falling asleep. One thing that, you know, we found with one of our PMs, actually, this was really interesting. I said, I want you to go and do genetic profiling and testing with 23andMe. We found that one of our PMs was susceptible to cognitive decline. He actually tested he had two alleles for Alzheimer's disease, and he didn't know anything about this. And I actually said to him, has anybody in your family? And he's like, you know what? My mother has Alzheimer's disease, but I didn't think that, you know, I didn't know how to, he didn't really know anything about how, if it was transferred to him or any, he just thought, I'll just see how it comes. And, you know, knowing this information can really save your life. So obviously he was then referred on to a neurologist, et cetera. And he's figured that out. But things, I never take things by chance. I do all the blood work for my parents. And so, yeah, why I'm saying this, like how it all ties in is, you really have to be deliberate in your efforts and your actions each day to get a good night's sleep.
Mm-hmm. And it's so funny because we see, like, Bill Ackman is a good example. When he was going through a lot of personal issues, divorce and all that stuff, his portfolio performance declined pretty significantly during that time. And it's easy to kind of point like, oh, his personal life was messed up, therefore his, you know, decision making and his investment decisions were suboptimal. But when you dig deeper and when you maybe hypothesize about these things, like, I wonder how much of it just goes back to lack of sleep. Because if you're dealing with a high cost divorce, dealing with everything that goes into that, you're probably not sleeping well. You're probably stressed throughout the day, which leads to suboptimal sleep. And it just seems like sleep is this common denominator where, like, you can enter like X stress here, like insert your stressor here. But at the end of the day, like, I wonder if stress isn't really what matters. It's how stress affects then the sleep. And then it's the sleep that matters.
Well, it is this cycle, because we know that when we sleep more, we're actually decreasing the inflammatory biomarkers that are involved in inflammation. So, and if you don't get those, if you don't get your sleep, you're raising your level of inflammation and cortisol. And then it says that prevents you from sleeping. Okay. So then you are delayed in the sleep, you know, the night after. And then that delayed obviously increases more, and it just keeps going on and going on and going on. And I keep saying to you that sleep is emotional first aid. I would love to see if you have any links. I'll probably put this out in my next newsletter, even bring it up at the Money Show, the correlation between his divorce, Bill Ackman, I love him, by the way, and his portfolio.
Yeah, I'll try
did
to.
Did you say how well his portfolio is performing?
Yeah, I'll try to pull that.
Yeah. But I'm sure that he's not the only one. I see it in my day-to-day experience as well.
Yeah. No, I'm sure that I'm going to pull up a couple things here. Because I think it was in 2016, 2017, where he got divorced. A nine-figure divorce.
But keeping in mind, that's incredible. Keeping in mind that he also has been open. I've tried so hard to figure out or research. I would love to spend some time with him to figure out if he's doing anything in the realm of sleep. However, he does say that he's hired his own nutritionist or chef, which is common. And he's got his own personal trainer. So he takes this into consideration. He looks great, by the way. I don't know if you've picked up on that, but he looks great.
He plays a lot of tennis. I would love to play tennis against Ackman. That'd be so fun.
I'd love to just sit down with him. And I know you can $10,000, but I don't want to pay that money to sit down. I just want to have lunch with him. So I might try and find out where he is and just, like, you know, walk up to him and say, would you like to grab lunch?
I'm looking at a Vanity Fair. What was it, from 2016, December 23rd, 2016. And it was about this time during his divorce. And the author, what is it? Emily Jane Fox says, quote, his hedge fund Pershing Square bled money and investors this year. Its assets under management plummeted to about $11.4 billion by this fall, down from $20 billion it had 18 months earlier. And then in the first half of the year, call it 2016, investors withdrew some $600 million from the firm. So I guess Murphy's Law, what can go wrong will go wrong. It is, like, I wonder how much of it is coincidence between when that started happening versus when his personal life started getting out of hand, and then how much of that bleeds in together.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that, you never know what's going on in somebody's life, right?
Yep.
You never know what's happening. You never know what they're, what having to go through and how they're sleeping and what's affecting their performance. But that's the beauty of this. It's like, I would love to figure out what's actually happening in his life.
Yeah. Switching gears completely here, I want to finish the conversation around microdosing and the future of consumer psychedelics, which is such a huge, huge topic, right? But I know that there's a lot of investor interest in some of these types of companies. So
really?
Yes. Yeah. I think Packy McCormick, he wrote a great article. Let me pull it up. He wrote a great article on a psychedelic company called, the name of the essay is The Magic of Mushrooms. And he talks about Compass Pathways, which is one of the public companies trying to do this psychedelic thing. So you had a conversation with Dr. David Rabin to discuss these psychedelics. And it was, one of the, I guess, premium conversations that you have for your paid members. What were some of those major takeaways from that conversation about psychedelics that maybe changed your mind about it from a consumer perspective?
Well, so this is what I love, and this is not my space. However, I am very, I'm very bullish on mushrooms in terms of psilocybin and lion's mane, for example. I know that the correlation between cognitive enhancement and lion's mane is incredibly vast. I've been taking lion's mane now for the past, I would say, 6 months, and I've noticed a considerable benefit in taking them in terms of cognitive performance. But what I found really interesting is this correlation between a psychedelic experience and major depressive disorder. And this is what Dr. Rabin and many people in his field are trying to do. They're trying to unlock this experience, which he's done. You know, if you go and look, if you go and listen to the episode, or you look at the Substack that I did, you'll show that he uses these, he uses controlled substances like magic mushrooms, like psilocybin, to elicit an experience that is somewhat correlated to like therapy, okay, or taking an SSRI. So basically he's saying that we don't need to put people with major depressive disorder on SSRIs or antidepressants, if you will, or they don't need to feel this way when in a single, you know, I don't know what the exact measurements were, but on a single two nights of psilocybin treatment or psychedelic treatment, I would say psychedelic therapy, he was able to achieve the same results as somebody who's been on an SSRI for a year. And I think that that's opening up the realm of psychedelics. You know, how can we heal trauma with psychedelics? How can we, you know, have these experiences and unlock these paradigms in our brain using psychedelic therapy? I think it's very promising. I think it's going to be highly regulated. But within this email, I spoke about who's going to be able to perform these. There's different laws in different states, but I think it's going to be a very, very, very big field, especially in the next, I would say 5-10 years. I think it's going to become more acceptable to say, I'm going to do a psychedelic experience. It's going to be under the control of an MD and his team. And yeah, we're going to see how I go.
So what does psilocybin or lion's mane do neurochemically that allows it to have, and again, this again might be out of your scope of you know, activity here, but to your best knowledge, why are those things so powerful as therapeutics?
You know, it is out of my realms of, you know, of going in and talking about it. I mean, if we stop the podcast and I go in and just have a look at some of the articles that I've done, I'd be able to explain it to you. I'm not sure, but I do know that that there is, I've read some articles, and by articles I mean like scientific papers on the realms of things such as I think it's turkey tail and psilocybin and lion's mane and different types of mushrooms. I've had them myself, not anything bad, not psilocybin. I have like the lion's mane drops in my coffee in the morning. And mm-hmm. I've noticed a difference for me. Whether it's a process, if I remember correctly, of decreasing neural inflammation, it's like the inflammation that occurs in your brain and nervous system, which then enables you to perform better and think clearer, whether it's that way or whether it's in aiding you to calm down the nervous system to get into a deep sleep state. Any of that, I'm more than happy to explore myself, to be completely honest.
Got it. I think the only time I've taken lion's mane is in, there's some like coffee thing that's got lion's mane.
The Four Sigmatic?
Yes, that's exactly it. Yep.
Yeah. I haven't taken that, but I have, I do regularly take the actual drops. And I'm looking up the company now. So yeah, Chaga is another type that I'm having. And you know what's really interesting, just while we're on that, a company in Australia sent me some deer antler velvet. Have you ever heard of that?
So I think I heard of that, and I might get this wrong because maybe this was like something related to deer, but there was a former NFL player, Ray Lewis, who used some sort of deer antler something, or maybe it was like even like deer urine or some wild thing. And he used that to treat like a pretty intense injury and was able to recover very fast. But I don't know anything about the deer velvet. So if you want to go into that, that'd be pretty fascinating.
Well, it was interesting. So what it, deer antler velvet, which sounds insane, but it's another thing which is part of this whole like mushrooms, like anybody who's like selling these, you know, lion's mane, et cetera, that they've now cultivated, and it's been shown to help with ligament damage, but also libido. And it's just another therapeutic intervention to give to some people on Wall Street who might be having the pharmacological aspect of libido and taking that in a little blue pill instead of taking a more natural form. But I thought that was really interesting. I haven't taken it yet because I take everything with caution. So I'm like looking at it, but that's a new thing that I've been trying out. But yeah.
That's fascinating. Yeah. I mean, I'm very much like you where there's a lot that I'm willing to try and experiment on. I'm just very cautious of doing that. So it's like, there's this high hurdle rate, but then once I get comfortable with it, it's like, all right, I'll start off very, so like the lion's mane or like different, you know, like I love energy drinks, like the Jocko Go, all the, like the natural nootropics and all that stuff like that. I used to drink Bangs and that was 300 milligrams of caffeine. And then I got jittery and felt like I was going to have a heart attack every time I drank one. But no, I mean, this has been a sweet conversation. It's very different than the straight everything about investing, but I think this relates as much to investing as any podcast that I've done, because if you don't get these things in order, then it doesn't matter how smart you are or how often you read or how often you do analysis. Like if you don't make optimal sharp decisions and if you don't take care of your body and take care of your brain, then none of that matters.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And I've actually had a really nice time talking with you about this.
Yeah. So we'll go right into the closing questions that I ask everybody. So specifically with you, what are the 1 to 2 takeaways you want to leave investors with when they hear the term neuroathletics?
Oh, wow. So it is that you have, in order to perform better, think faster and live longer, you have to have a better functioning or optimally functioning brain. In order to have that, you need to understand what's actually happening in your brain. And that's what neuroathletics does.
Got it. And then where can people go to find out more about you? I know you're on Twitter. I know you've got a Substack. Give those a shout out.
Yes, Twitter is Louisa Nicola, which is my name. We have a Substack. It's called the Neuroathletics Newsletter, and that goes out to 30,000 investors and athletes. And then I'm on Instagram as well. You can just type in my name or go to the neuroathletics.com.au website.
There you go. And then third question, what are some passions and hobbies outside of running your business or outside of studying neurology and neuroscience?
If I was in Australia, I'd say surfing. I grew up around the water, but now I love to get out in nature. I hate the gym. I loathe doing weights. I go to the gym, but if I could go out and walk mountains and hike for 3 or 4 hours at a time. So I spend an hour every single morning going for really, really big walks. And I live near Central Park, so I'm usually there. So that's one of my passions, just getting out into nature.
You mentioned, you know, if you were in Australia, what are your thoughts on what they're doing to crack down on the COVID situation? I mean, it's obviously a hot topic, but it is nutty to see.
Yeah. It's actually an emotional topic for me. I'm Greek. And if you know anything about Greeks, you know that we, when we migrated to Australia, a lot of my family members opened up businesses in the form of whether it's a clothing store, whether it's a sandwich shop, like it's small business owners is what we do. And they've been heavily affected due to the lockdowns. That upsets me. It upsets me the way that they're treating expats. Like myself, for example, I can't even go home to visit my family. It would cost me $25,000, which scares me. Not just that, there's hardly any flights. And that really scares me. I have a father who is turning 70 soon. I have a 65-year-old mother. And the thought of not being able to go there during this time really plays on my emotions. And just this whole, like when you have, here's the difference. You have, our prime minister had the opportunity to get the vaccine like the rest of the world. He chose not to, which has put a very, very big halt on now the entire nation having Pfizer available to them. So that upsets me as well. So this whole process, when you see it as an outsider, you think, wow, look what they're doing for lockdowns. Like, you know, they're putting them in hotel rooms and that's detrimental. Putting somebody in a hotel room without, you know, they've got windows, some of them don't have windows, but without getting like actual air is traumatic in itself for 14 days. So I think they've done everything wrong and I'm very upset about the situation.
Yeah, I'm so sorry to hear that. I've just been scrolling through Twitter and it just made me realize, like, you know, you've got you know, Australian background, I'm like, man, like this is insane. What's going on? It's heartbreaking to see. It's heartbreaking to see. But let's we'll try to end on a more positive note here, which is the last question that I ask everybody.
I'm mad now.
Yeah. If you could have dinner with one person from the past or the present, who would it be and why?
Jennifer Lopez. And that's because
that was very quick.
I've been my entire career. I know people may think, well, she's a bit crazy now. No, I've been her number one fan, actually. To date, she actually put me in her biography since
Did
the age
really?
Of 10. Yeah. And in her, I'm in her documentary as well, since the age of 10. So I've followed her entire career since the age of 10. I'm now 33. So it's a long time. And I've never sat down to, I've met her several times. I've never sat down to have dinner with her. So that's somebody who I'd like to see apart from Oprah and, you know, but yeah, I'd love to sit down with J-Lo.
That's fascinating. So she mentioned you in her book, just like, hey, here's my number one fan, or like how did she introduce you?
Actually, yes. So well, in her documentary, the lady said, so you've got, you know, you've amassed hundreds of millions of fans. Is there anybody that sticks out? She goes, you know what? There is this one girl from Australia. And then they showed me, and I went on stage with her and I sung. That was interesting. I didn't know that was going to happen. And then a week after that, she released her autobiography, and there was a huge photo of me in there, which my mother has framed, by the way. And there, I didn't even know about that until other people told me. And so I actually came to America because I was like, you know, one day I really want to be working for, I want her to hire Neuro Athletics. So she hasn't done that yet. But one day.
I'm sure it's coming.
Yeah. We're going to sit down over dinner and talk about that.
There you go. And then it'll be a business write-off, because it'll be just discussing Neuro Athletics. There you go.
Exactly.
It's a win-win. Yeah. Awesome. Well, this has been such an awesome conversation, Louisa. I know others are going to get a lot of information out of this, and I hope people listen to this a couple times and take notes about the power of sleep and the power of decision making and how really everything's this loop. And I really hope the other thing is people internalize this idea of that tunnel made of steel that you alluded to earlier. I think that was kind of the coolest part of this whole thing. So again, thanks so much for taking, you know, an hour and a half out of your day. And, you know, I wish you the best of luck with your business, and I hope that you can go back and see your family someday. You know, hopefully we can, you know, Australia can make that happen.
Thanks so much, Brandon.
This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional-level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally, with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. ValueHive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive.